I have been working on child advocacy issues for the last 6 years in my role at the National Council of Churches. But before that, I did a graduate degree in early childhood education, and that was my work for approximately 8 or 9 years. I was the director of a nursery school in New York City. So I come to this with a background in early childhood education, and also many of you have seen my two small children and know that I'm currently right now being a mother of young children as well. I'd like to just get a sense of who is here. Hi. How many of you all are involved in early childhood education? Now, some of you told me this yesterday, but so we know a little bit about each other. If you are involved in education of young children outside of your own family, would you raise your hands?
Well, I don't know exactly
what you
mean.
Well,
like in
sure.
Church or
anywhere, in a Sunday school setting, in a community setting, in a daycare center, in a nursery school, in a family daycare home, in a variety. Okay. And how many of you all have children or have had or have raised children? So that's all of us, just about. Okay, and just for my information, how many of you all are working in a, when you're saying you're working with children, are working in a church setting? So most of us are working in secular settings with children. Okay. What we're going to talk about today is raising children to love and respect, and how the issue, how racism gets in our way of doing that. Sexism. I said racism. Racism we did yesterday. Sexism we're talking about today. We are talking about sexism. How sexism gets in the way of raising children to fully love and respect other people and themselves. So why don't we just talk a little bit first about what is sexism, so that we all can share some of our ideas, but also so that we're starting from a similar point and know what each other means when we say sexism. What do people think of when we talk about sexism?
I think of assumption of role models, assumption of role behaviors.
Okay, say a little bit more. Yeah, okay.
Assumption of behaviors of each sex, I guess. I don't think that's said very well. But
sometimes it said gender behavior. Does that
yeah,
feel better?
Uh-huh. Right.
Is that right? I don't
uh-huh.
know. Yeah, okay.
Our assumptions of certain things that each gender is supposed to do in this life.
Okay, so for example.
For example, when my husband went to display or to demonstrate spinning on his spinning wheel in the first grade class, and the little boy said, "I thought women did that."
Okay. Okay, so men don't spin, only women do.
Yeah, men don't spin.
Okay, so that would be an example of assumptions. Okay. What else do people think of when they think of sexism?
More of your options being limited because of your sex, and that may be behavior as well. I mean, it's less occupations than it used to be.
Okay, so your options are limited, and that would include employment? Is that employment or vocation?
Yeah, I think that's less so than it used to be. I'm thinking more of just expectations of behavior.
I think it still happens that it's more acceptable for little boys to be loud and active, and it's more expected that little girls will be mm-hmm. quiet and well-mannered.
Okay, so could that be another example of assumptions? Mm-hmm. Okay. So that.
And that's a real limiting thing for
boys
of all ages.
Boys are loud. So we say boys or males.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that it's not just when they're young children. Okay. Girls or females are quiet and...
Almost submissive, probably. I don't remember what else I said.
Yeah.
Well behaved, I guess.
Nurturing, that was a good...
And somebody else said nurturing, which is certainly a very good point.
Submissive.
Well, that's a real good one.
Nurturing.
I think with boys, I said loud and active.
Can we return to that one?
Sure, just a sec. Submissive, nurturing, and well behaved.
We need to board that.
Now, going back to this one?
Sometime, if you want to complete.
No, go ahead.
Well, this one of all the others that have been so far mentioned is interesting to me because I wonder about the extent to which these behavior patterns are just natural and in fact part of sex identification genetically and or hormonally to some extent. Now, with the exception of the word submissive, you know, across that one, I can just say.
See, what I originally said was I think it's more acceptable in a classroom situation for boys to be loud and active. And it's expected that girls would be quiet and nurturing and well behaved.
But what you're saying is that you have a question about whether some of these things are actually genetic and not socialized?
Just that one.
The one about loud?
Yeah, loud and active and more aggressive.
And what's the big, and where does this kind of query come from?
I'm wondering about the effect of hormones on behavior. And that even young children, boys, and I don't know this for a scientific fact, but may well have some type of hormonal interplay with their brain that affects their behavior patterns, and that this had, and maybe still has, survival benefit for the human race, and it came to be that way for a reason. So that, to some extent, boys are loud and more active, and there's not a whole lot you can do about it to deaden that out, because it's part of their natural way of being, for the reason that you said, whereas girls, with the effects of female hormones, affect the brain and behavior, therefore, in different ways.
Mm-hmm. Does anybody have a thought about that?
I feel that's right, because when I was carrying my son, he kicked, you know, I mean, it was before he was affected by the environment, by the this environment. He kicked, whereas the second baby, when I carried my daughter, it was wiggled. You know, she wiggled. I knew it was a girl because it was totally different from this. So there you have the gender that I feel like the boy was more active and aggressive even before he was born.
How about a couple other comments? Why don't we have one, two, and then we'll...
I have the exception. So the boy who's quiet and the girl who's loud and very advanced.
Yeah.
From in utero right through their early childhood. Go ahead. Yeah.
Well, I was thinking I haven't had enough pregnancies to judge, you know, a clinical, you know, experiment. Enough pregnancies to say, okay, this all these. Anyway, what I was thinking is in my classroom, I know that boys can be taught just as girls can be taught to. Respect other people's need for quiet, to respect other people's body space, and so forth. So I guess what I'm thinking is, in relation to the first comment that was made, maybe what she was saying is that the sexism would be expecting to make an exception for boys to be loud and interrupting and boisterous and cannot control themselves, and expecting girls to be able to, whereas you're going to have girls who can't control themselves any easier than any other given person in the population.
Okay. So we've got disagreement on this point and some additional questions.
And I think Desley has expressed exactly what I meant in terms of that being sexism, making those kinds of assumptions as being sexism.
Was there another comment over here?
I wasn't, but I just absolutely, totally disagree with that. I mean, I realize it's just theory, but I just think it's, I can hardly keep my face straight.
Okay, go ahead,
Linda. I just think it's totally learned and totally, that whole thing with expecting and all that, and I believe it's a cult. I do believe it has to do with survival, but I don't think it's biological. I think it's a cultural expectation.
Okay, Linda?
My comment was going to be in family daycare where none of the children are mine, so it's more of a teaching setting. But, and I agree that the boys can be taught and do, are very respectful. But the interesting thing is when they're playing, almost invariably I see a nurturing kind of house playing occurring with girls. Two boys on the deck, and immediately they've taken two of the riding toys and their bumper cars or their guns. Just immediately two boys in a playing kind of non-structured situation coming from two, and it was a very interesting one afternoon, two boys, two separate families, both extremely peaceful families. Bought horns in less than 30 seconds and were loving it. Mm.
I think that we've really sort of gotten hold of one of the biggest debates that goes on in early childhood education and in parenting, which is that whole argument about how much is genetics and how much is social environment and how much is learned by children. And we don't really know the answer to that. We do know that in early childhood classrooms, oftentimes boys are very loud and boisterous. I know when I was directing a school, I would always make sure that I had an even balance of girls and boys, because if I had 15 boys and 2 girls, my classroom was going to be a different kind of classroom than if I had 15 girls and 2 boys. But I don't know. I mean, is that genetics? Or how much of that is genetics?
Well,
and how much of that is socialization? It has to be both.
I'm
being
so adamant because I saw it at an extremely early age. Mm-hmm. My son didn't watch any TV. He didn't have any older kids to play with. And he'd be picking up things and wham, throwing them. And I'd been around little girls and the same thing. Just, and it bothered me a lot because my husband and I consider ourselves very committed to nonviolence, and it has a deep value for us. And here we went through the whole thing about guns and weapons, and now our little boys out there running around with sticks and jumping all the other little boys. And right. We've kind of come to terms with it, but
they play with other little boys.
But he was doing it before he was around any other boys.
And he didn't have any TV to watch.
You're right is that it is both. And that we don't have a lot of solid research which says how much of it is genetics and how much of it is socialization. But we do know, is there are certain things that have been, that are assumptions, which are probably at least partially socialized, that we may not want, that on the basis of some genetics, we've built assumptions beyond what is probably realistic, that the expectation that men, that boys are loud and active is unfair because all boys are not that way. Mm-hmm. And all boys are not genetically that way, and no boys are completely that way. All of us have different sides to us, so that any assumption which is hard and fast one way or another is going to do disservice not only to that child, but to all the children with whom he or she interacts. So I would like to suggest that not only are these assumptions, but that they become something more than assumptions. They become stereotypes. And stereotypes are something that we need to be more aware of and more cautious of and more leery of, because it's on the basis of stereotypes that other assumptions get made on which we have no basis for fact. So that I might expect, I have a 4-year-old girl coming into my classroom, she will undoubtedly be these things, because that is a stereotype that I have learned, when in reality it's not based on fact. I don't know that little girl yet. I don't know her family. I don't know her set of experiences. I don't know how she interacts with other children. I may be very wrong. So that stereotype is a dangerous thing to use in terms of working with young children. We need to be aware of not engaging in stereotypes, because they are not realistic and they will not do us well, vis-a-vis those children and those families. Is there anything else that people want to raise about sexism?
One thing, I don't know whether it flows out of or because of it's an assumption or a stereotype, but the value put on these actions and work. You see it when it comes to employment, that women's employment is less valued than men's, or the type of activities that women do in a larger portion is not as valued as the activity that more men do.
Do you want to be any more specific than that?
An equal pay. Yeah. Well, especially in the area of equal pay. Or at least maybe
put a value placed on being a homemaker.
Right.
Yeah, especially that.
Which is also unequally paid.
Or the validity of an opinion. See, yeah. I don't know how much of this is left over. I think that the stereotype of women, in my experience, has changed dramatically since I was a child in the 50s. And I think we're moving in the right direction, but I think there's probably a lot of this still around, including, in a business setting, let's say, perhaps a woman's opinion, though it may be very important, in fact, correct, may be discounted by their male colleague.
Yeah, so what we're actually talking about now is we're talking about going beyond stereotypes to institutionalization of views and attitudes. So that we're talking about these stereotypes actually becoming part of a system in which we live. And of course, anytime we're dealing with a system, we're dealing with something which is much more fundamental. And so if we're dealing with sexism in our society as a system of attitudes and stereotypes which confront children, young children in their lives, then we're really talking about something about which we have to be very, very careful, about something because they're going to feel it in all different places in their lives. They're going to feel it from television, from books, from the bus, from the playground, from the family, from all the different places. And so, and a lot of it is that where we don't necessarily have control, or we have limited control. So it becomes something that we have to become very aware of. And in terms of being interested in raising children who are non-sexist, we have to be proactive to confront those situations where children are beginning to take on those sexist stereotypes and those sexist gender behavior because of what they see around them in their environment. I'd like to just let me read you actually a definition which I like. Sexism is any attitude, action, or institutional practice backed up by an institutional power that subordinates people because of their sex. I think that puts it in a different plane for us. It means that it is a system, that it is institutionalized, that we have to face it on many different levels. I'd like to just read a couple of stories that are from actual classroom experience. I read a couple about race bias yesterday, racism in young children, but I'd like to read a couple about sexism today. These are actual stories from preschool classrooms. Try and read without my glasses here. Judy and Marie ask John to play doctor with them. John wants to be the nurse, but Judy doesn't agree. You can't be the nurse. You have to be the doctor, she firmly states. Their teacher intervenes. But both boys and girls can be doctors and nurses. In fact, Judy, your dad told me that you used to go to a woman doctor. She was a nurse, insists Judy. Mm-hmm. Well, her teacher continues, feeling a little stymied. You may not think that women can be doctors and men can be nurses, but I do, and John does. So I want you to let John be the nurse. Judy agrees, albeit reluctantly. This is about a little girl named Sarah, who was also 4 years old, I believe. Sarah says, this is about a little girl named Heather. Sarah says, I'm not a girl because I like to play rough. Heather complains to her teacher, teary-eyed. Do you think that you are still a girl? Her teacher asks. Heather shrugs her shoulders. Well, you are still a girl. You will be a girl no matter what you like to do. Your body makes you a girl, not how you play. I know you like to play rough, and that's just fine. Now let's explain this to Sarah and tell her that she hurt your feelings by saying that you aren't a girl. third story, again, four-year-olds. A small group is playing with a teacher-made classification game. Cards depict girls, boys, men, women, and various toys and materials, and the children are deciding which objects go with which people. Peter decides that the Play-Doh has to go with the girls, because only girls play with Play-Doh. In spite of the fact that he was playing with Play-Doh just that morning, and it's one of his favorite activities. But his teacher questions Peter, "Don't you like to play with Play-Doh?" Peter nods his head, "Yes." "You were making wonderful things with Play-Doh this morning, weren't you?" "Lots of other boys also like to play with Play-Doh." "What other boys were at the Play-Doh table with you this morning?" Peter names one boy. His teacher helps him recall two more. Other children who have been listening chime in. "I like to play with Play-Doh too," Jose says. "My dad plays with me at home," says Kimmy. "So, is it true that only girls play with Play-Doh?" the teacher asks. Peter and the other children say, "No." Okay, and this is the last one. This is, this last one, well, let me read it to you first, and then I'll raise one question about it. Rose, an active four-year-old, asks her teacher, "How do you think I look today?" The teacher says, "Well, I think you look fine. Why?" Rose, "Sometimes I think I look ugly." The teacher, "But why?" Rose, "I don't know. I just do. I look like a boy." Teacher, "Do you think you look ugly because you look like a boy?" Rose, "Yes." The teacher, "But why do you think you look like a boy?" Rose, "Boys wear jeans and shirts," which are Rose's favorite clothes. The teacher says, "Do you think you have to wear a dress to look pretty?" "Yes." Teacher, "You know you also look pretty in jeans and a t-shirt, and sometimes it's easier to play in jeans and a t-shirt because they don't tear as easily. You don't look like a boy. You look like Rose no matter what you wear." And that is the bottom line. When we're talking about sexism and raising children who are non-sexist, we need to realize that there are two components to gender identity.
You know what, I wanted to say one thing about the first story that really bothered me. Because mm-hmm. all those references to authorities, well, your father told me that you used to go to a woman doctor. And then there was something else about some other authority figure that was trying to impose this viewpoint on the teacher.
Well, the teacher did, because the little girl wouldn't accept it.
Yeah, and then the teacher sort of mm-hmm. said, "Well, I think that."
Yeah,
I didn't like that particular exchange too much.
It's hard when you want to expose your child or a child to what is a possibility or reality, but all you can do is tell them or show them pictures or whatever. But when they keep running up against their own reality. That it's contrary to what you would like it to be. Mm-hmm. That's kind of, for me, the dilemma.
And that's the point at which you have to begin to think about how you can expose them to a different set of, a different environment or different books or a different set of experiences so that their experience begins to change. But we do run into the situation where a child, even though his or her own experience is one way, that he or she buys into a stereotype which is different. Regardless of what their own experience says.
Mm-hmm. In that first story, the teacher was trying to deal with two situations. One was the boy who had an idea that he could be a nurse, and the other was this girl that had this other viewpoint. And when you're dealing with in a classroom, you're obviously thinking about more than one child. So how do you help to honor his thinking and also help her to think about things in a mm-hmm. new way without mm-hmm. squelching her own thinking process?
Well, what do you think? Or what do other people think?
Yeah.
Well, the teacher did say John wants to be a nurse now. Why don't we let him be a nurse? Mm-hmm. And then kind of came back to the bottom, but if he wants to do it this way, can we do it this way? So, and she agreed to that.
Well, we also don't have to think of this as just a single frame vignette. I mean, when you're working with young children, it's an ongoing experience that you have, and it may be that this is the initiation of an ongoing discussion and dialogue that the children have in their classroom, which might involve a variety of different things, including pictures and books and visits to a health center or visits from parents who are in health professions, a variety of different things, or it could be any other thing, but it probably means that the people responsible, i.e. the teacher, perhaps her director, his or her director, and the parents need to think together about, well, what do we do? I mean, what can we do in terms of helping our children think more openly, more creatively, more critically about some of these issues? I wanted to raise an issue about the last one, which was the one about Rose, who wanted to always wear shirts and jeans. I think this is a complicated one, because, because not all parents believe that. Some parents don't like their children, don't like their daughters to wear jeans and shirts. And I was brought up short because, I mean, that's not, I myself dress Elizabeth, who most people think is a boy, in jeans and shirts and all the time, because I think for her, she's not a particularly out there kind of child, and I want her to be as free as possible to do whatever she wants in terms of climbing and running and getting dirty, etc., etc. But I was brought up short when I was thinking about this this time together today by the presentation that Ruby did yesterday, and by her presence in our workshop, because there are cultural differences, and in some cultures, parents. And it may be that, and the reason I thought of it is because I think some African American or black parents do not want their daughters to look sloppy or unkempt or raggedy or in hand-me-downs or whatever it might be. And that's a very, that may come from a very carefully thought through cultural perspective and expected of experience. And Ruby was talking about how for African American or black families, that sometimes it's how you look is critically important in terms of being accepted, being praised, being affirmed. That for children of color, they, because of the racism in our society, they are more likely to be not affirmed if they don't have on very nice clothes or don't look nicely. So I think that, you know, there's a fine line here. We have to be very careful. I mean, on the one hand, it's true that if children are yelled at because they get their clothes dirty, they're not going to engage in those kind of activities. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, there are the cultural norms that we have to respect. And so it becomes a careful kind of balance of being sensitive to the families and working with the families and perhaps finding ways of accommodating both perspectives, like having smocks available, wearing your jeans for only part of the day, whatever it might be. But I think that, you know, as people working with diverse families, we just have to be aware and sensitive that there aren't necessarily right and wrongs, and that the well-being of the child is the bottom line.
Is this your experience in a preschool in a cosmopolitan city that children, that girls will come dressed in fancy clothes?
Yes.
The experience in our community is that preschool and kindergarten children wear casual play clothes. It's really discouraged to dress them up. And people do show their snobbery by putting them in expensive play clothes.
Yeah.
But dresses and jumpers and things like that are totally discouraged.
My experience is, I mean, some of the children in daycare centers that I know in New York City, wear dresses because they want to, and they drive their parents wild because they like to be, you know, they're trying to figure out their gender identity and their, you know, frilly stuff. It's, what does this mean? And they're trying it on for size. That's one thing. But my experience was when I worked in North Philadelphia in a Get Set program, which is a program comparable to the Head Start program. You can't generalize, but there are families who really want their children to look nice. And all I'm saying is that we just need to be sensitive.
There was a saying one time that said the children act according to where they're dressed, and I don't know how much truth there is to that. But you know, that goes back a ways. If you know, if you dress them nicely, then they behave nicely. But give them, you know, rough clothes, and then that's the way they play.
And that's part of the argument, I think, that, you know, that Ruby and Moses might argue with us, that, you know, it's important to look nice, and, you know, that the way you dress is a sign of respect and seriousness about the tasks in which you're involved, et cetera, et cetera. And all I'm saying is that I think that, you know, in different parts of our culture and different parts of our society have different sets of experiences and approach things differently. And I think that what we need to do is to remember that the child's well-being is the bottom line, and that we need to think about what the family is bringing to the situation, what we as early childhood educators or people with experience working with children are bringing to a situation, and we have to think very carefully about what is the best thing for that child, and work it out together. It's not easy. It involves growing on everybody's part, I think.
Do you see children who come, little girls who come and with dresses on that are just feel very free and feel like they can participate in any activity?
Some. But they're the people, they're the parents who don't care if they get dirty.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there's not a lot of parents who dress their children nicely and then don't care if they get dirty. Yeah. You know, so. Let's see. I wanted to share just a little bit of background before we begin thinking about what are some of the things then that we can do to counter some of the sexist stereotypes and assumptions in our society when we're working on children. But I want to reiterate for people that heard yesterday just a little bit of child development theory, and that is that when children are 2 years old, they are learning color names and learning gender names and beginning to figure out what's a boy, what's a girl. My daughter has been working on this for the last year and a half. You know, well, I'm a girl and Daniel's a boy and Mommy's a girl and Grandma's a girl. But they work very hard, and they start doing this by the time they're two, which means that the pre-prejudices and the sexism are attitudes and stereotypes that children begin to learn as early as 2 years old. By the time they're 3 years old, they're really hard at work trying to figure out who they are. I mean, my daughter does this all the time. In fact, she was doing it, she does it in terms of families. The other day she said, well, I mean, she's sort of, anyway, she says, well, I'm a girl, and when I get older, I'm going to be a mommy. And my baby is going to be Daniel's child. Now, Daniel is her brother, but that's, you know, she hasn't figured out that piece of it yet. My baby is going to be Daniel's child. And she's going to me, you're going to be the grandmother. But the point of it is that they work very hard to figure all this stuff out. If they're getting confusing messages and sexist assumptions and stereotypes from books, from television, from their environment, that's what they're going to use to build their understanding of gender identity and gender roles. That's why we need to, with very young children, to be very consciously aware of giving them information which is going to enable them to put together a picture, an understanding of our world, which is one that we want them to have, one which we believe is the healthiest and most realistic for them. By the time children are 4 and 5, they have adopted for themselves many of the socially acceptable stereotypes. So that's when you begin to see children playing out these sexist kinds of stories, ones that we sort of go, you know, but by 4 or 5, they have picked these things up and are playing them out, because they're still trying to understand it. I mean, it isn't set in stone yet, but they're still trying to understand it. So what it means on the one hand is that we have to be cautious about the sort of thing. On the other hand, it means that this is the point at which we have our biggest and best opportunity to really help them think about it and help them to build an understanding which is realistic and correct about their world. Now, the goal of an anti-bias approach, or an approach which is anti-sexist or anti-racist, or which counters the stereotypes and assumptions, the institutionalization of stereotypes in our society, we do that for a number of reasons. I mean, first and foremost, we do it because we want that child to get a realistic understanding of what his or her own gender identity and gender role is, what those two things are. Secondarily, We do it because we want their experience and their play to be open. We want them to be, we don't want them to be constrained by stereotypes, so that a little girl doesn't play in the block corner, a little boy doesn't try on the dress-up clothes, a little girl doesn't run to the top of the dirt hill and scream at the top of her lungs, or a little boy doesn't hold the doll and rock it to sleep. I mean, what we want children to grow into full human beings and want them to be feel free to try on all these different kinds of activities, try it all out, see what it means, so that men can be nurturing. Let's see, one thing that we said, men can be nurturing, men can be quiet, men can behave well. and girls can be active, can be loud, that we all have all those capacities. And we want our children to be able to live and experience the full range of who they are, not to be in any way limited. The third reason we have an anti-bias approach is that we want our children, girls and boys, to begin to think critically about our society. We want to give them tools for thinking about the stereotypes. We want to give them tools for thinking about some of the assumptions. We want to give them tools for changing some of the institutionalized sexism if they so choose to do so. Thinking critically is one of the most critical things that we can give a child, give any student, give anyone growing up, and certainly in this area, no less than others. Any thoughts?
Sounds like a good idea.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, whenever I start talking a lot, I want to make sure that we sort of process it, because it isn't good pedagogy for one person to talk all the time. All right? So let's think a little bit about things that we can do to counter sexism. And this is in a classroom, at home, in a Sunday school room, in your church, whatever. What are some of the things that we can do?
Try to have children see men and women in a variety of different roles.
Okay.
Just for like simple examples, is in the home, it's real helpful if both parents are seen working in the kitchen at times, or both parents are seen mowing the lawn at times. Of course, there's always, an additional agenda here. It's also very helpful from each person's point of view to have some involvement of both people.
Okay. I would suggest that we could do it at work as well, in employment situations at home, and well, in employment situations.
Or finding women pediatricians,
right?
It's something that's obviously done here at Holton. We attempt to have men and women working in many different areas.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because I saw a lady out on the roof running the buildings.
Yeah. Right.
Kneeling. She was the only one up there.
That's right. Right.
We have
right.
Men doing Waitry and other kinds of housekeeping and so on.
I'm emphasizing to our children the whole world of opportunity is available to them out there, what they might want to study or do or become.
Uh-huh. The whole world?
Well, the whole gamut of human activity out there. If you want to be a lawyer, you can be a lawyer. If you want to be a vet, you can be a vet.
You can do anything you want?
You can do anything you want. If you have the aptitude for it, work for it, and what? Just give them that message.
Okay. Of course, if we take this seriously, we have to, make sure that we also deal with the racism and the class prejudice and all the other things. But, okay. What else can we do to counter the sexism?
Well,
What about books?
Well, I found a great book. I was so surprised. It's Richard Scarry's drawing. It's not one of his books, but it's Frances Fixit. And it's female Frances. She's a little rabbit, this is everything. And all right, boy is definitely into tools and different things. And he thinks Dad can break his toys. When he breaks the toys, well, Dad can fix it. So you think I can?
No.
Well, let me try, okay? Sometimes he'll let me and sometimes he won't, because he thinks that only Dad can. And usually I am the one that fixes it.
Uh-huh. So, well, you're raising another point is to be role models ourselves.
Yeah, we try and make an effort. In fact, my husband's better at this thing than I am, that if Kevin gets hurt, he'll kind of run to him sometimes and be the comforter or the nurturer. It's a conscious effort, though, to say, okay, you as the man, you do this comforting here and nurturing.
Which means that we are, I mean, if we're going to take this seriously, it means that we have to be real vigilant about those sexist pieces of ourselves which keep rearing their ugly heads.
I think sometimes it's really hard to find that material, and one of the things I've done in life with my little daughter is that I'll actually change the words. You look through the library, it's tough to find what you're looking for. Yeah. But she's not at the age that she always picks out and changes it.
My daughter's just turned 9, and she, this last year, around Christmas, I ordered the new RS, whatever Bible that's a little less sexist, and she insists that we always read out of that one. Because she's, and what was it, oh, we were reading a devotional book, and she's, can't you read one that doesn't always talk about men? So now I'm very careful to change the word.
Yeah. Our daughter said the same thing. She said, you know, all the characters on Sesame Street are boys. I mean, you know, the obvious ones. It's interesting, the original ones, it's Ernie, Big Bird, Oscar, Grover. And it's interesting that I brought a, we're not going to have time to go through all this stuff, but I brought a lot of materials to look at. And it's interesting now that they're trying to do something about that. So now Big Bird has, it's unclear whether she's a mother or a sister, and Grover has a mother or a sister. I mean, there's now there's Betty Lou, and there's a number of other characters in there. But Sesame Street realized that they themselves were perpetuating some of these sexist kind of, the way that they were only had boys, only male models. So they're beginning to try and change, but they've got a ways to go too. Yes.
One of the things that was good for me about books is that I don't want the information to come from me as a lecture, the wisdom from my mouth. I want them to see it. And I can't always arrange for, you know, we live in a small town, we're not here, a female pediatrician. I'm like, it's not realistic for a lot of people. It would be wonderful. What I would like is for them to learn it from things I can arrange and from books and pictures, and not so much from my lecturer talking about it and counteracting verbally. For example, one thing my older daughter has found out from her experience is that all boys are messy, all girls are neat. No matter what I say, all boys are messy. I mean, I've talked about, we have a male friend who's a doctor, he's just a very fastidious person. So he is the exception, but still, all boys are messy, all girls are neat. Now, I don't know at what point, you know, I don't know what to do with that. I think
you're on the right track, because children learn from their experience. They don't learn from what we say very well. They learn from touching things and from experiencing things. And if that's how they learn, then we need to create those kinds of experiences for them. Lecturing is not going to do it. It's not tactile enough. It's not three-dimensional enough. It's not interactive enough. So what you're talking about is exactly right. I'd like to, along that line, I'd like to just mention this book, which is something I've been using all week. It's called The Anti-Bias Curriculum, Tools for Empowering Young Children, published by the National Association for the Education of Young Children. Among other things, it has a bibliography of children's books at the back, which is very, very good and very, very helpful. And I would it's a good place to start when you're looking at some of these things. It also has the names and the names and addresses of organizations that work specifically on issues of sexism as well as issues of racism and other issues of stereotyping, so that you could contact those organizations as well. And there are, you know, I think there are certain bookstores where you can write. If you're in a place where there isn't a bookstore available with these kinds of resources, there are places like the Bank Street Bookstore in New York City where you could write, or you could ask the Holden Library to, you know, get a couple titles or whatever. But I recommend this as a resource. What about dress-up clothes?
I was going to raise this question in the preschool. There's all kinds of toys, but I always feel, how much should I kind of push or encourage the boys to play with the dress-up clothes and the girls to play with the cars and trucks in the sandbox? I mean, the idea is to let them do what they want to do. And how much do we encourage or push trying to do the new things that only the other sex does? You know, and
what do people think?
I don't know if it's been mentioned about peer pressure, but they get that awfully young, you know, and they run the risk. A little boy brings it down. That's what pulls men for the risk of getting hurt from it.
And yet, if we take seriously the fact that sexism is an institutional problem in our society, then we as people who understand that and have an analysis of what it is, how it happens, we also have the responsibility, I believe, to do something about it. And it doesn't. I don't think it has to be done in a way which jeopardizes that child vis-a-vis their peers. I mean, for example, if it's only boys who are playing in the block corner, there are ways in which we could move children into the block corner. We could move girls into the block corner. For example, we might move woodworking experiences into the homemaking area. We might, you know, fix the table or build a chair or make a little toaster or something like that, and the children who are already in that area could thereby get involved in some woodworking activities. If the boys are the only folks in the block area and they never do anything else, well then let's move in some props into the block area. Let's take in some art supplies and make some signs and draw some pictures and build some furniture or draw some people and put them on blocks, or let's move some of the other activities into the block corner. So that on the one hand, the boys begin to do those other things, and then girls get drawn in because it's something that they're more familiar with. I think there are ways in which we can help children to try out other things that they may not be otherwise comfortable with.
The home economics rooms are real good about encouraging boys to cook and sew and things like that, at least where I come from.
They become better.
They're right there in the middle. They're all sewing. Right. They're all cooking, and I think that's great.
I think the thing about clothes is very interesting and it's important to think about. We don't necessarily have to have all the answers. I noticed, I've been taking my children over to Narnia, and I've been taking them over in the evenings as well with them myself. And I noticed that there are the dress-up clothes, they have these wonderful frilly dresses, flouncy hats, scarves. There are no male clothes.
And haven't been either. I mean, dress-ups are girls.
Which means that girls can't try on those clothes, and the only clothes that are there available for boys are the dresses and the flouncy hats.
Oh, now, I was wondering why. I didn't have any problem with my son not dressing up, but now that you bring this idea into it, I realize my dress-up box has suit jackets, pants, hat, old man's shoes, tie, as well as women's clothes.
And I think one of the underlying problems with all this is the fear of homosexuality.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And that we have to be very clear that that's what's going on. We have to be very clear that there is absolutely no research anywhere which suggests that if boys dress up in female clothes, they will become gay men. There's absolutely no research for it anywhere. And likewise, if girls constantly try on little boys' clothes or male clothes, that they will become lesbians.
Has there been any evidence one way or the other? Has there been any work at all done?
Yes, there has been research which shows that there's no difference.
No correlation.
There's no correlation. There's no correlation.
It's obviously cultural, because last week we were at a French family camp and all the counselors were from Quebec. And their main activity in the evening was putting on skits, and the guys were always dressed in female clothes as part of their come up. they thought nothing of it. Some of the other men from the English families were looking at them a little bit. These French counselors do this, but.
When I was down there, there was one little boy who was fully decked out. He had on a gorgeous pink dress and a gray wig and a matching pink hat. I mean, he had color coordinated his outfit perfectly. He looked terrific. And his mother took his picture and thought it was great. And then sort of set aside, is this right? Should I be allowing him to do this? And that's very deep in all of us. And I think that this brings up another thing in terms of sexual identity and gender identity, that most of us have not really dealt with how we feel about gay and lesbian people and how we feel about homosexuality. And it's another piece that we really need to address in ourselves if we're going to enable and empower our children to think very clearly about their gender identity and their gender roles. As teachers, we need to accept the fact that there are a lot of different kinds of families among the families that we work with. And some of those families will be families with two mommies or two daddies or one couple of which decided that they were gay or lesbian and therefore the family unit dissolved. But we have to be aware that there are a lot of different kinds of families. We have to be sensitive to that. We may not agree with it, but the bottom line is the well-being of the child in this situation. I mean, I think we need to deal with that issue ourselves, but the bottom line is the child and affirming the child. Likewise, there is no research anywhere that a child growing up with parents who are gay or lesbian will themselves be homosexual. There's absolutely no research at all. The number of children who grow up in gay families and become gay themselves is equivalent to the number of children who grow up in straight families and become homosexual. There is no correlation there whatsoever, and the research has been done. We ourselves need to deal with any fears we have around homosexuality.
There was a speaker last year, at the end of July, she was a lesbian, came in and really gave some nice talks and explained what they are, how they are, and how at 22 or 23 she became a lesbian, was as straight as anybody, and said, the two of them, we're talking about that, and I got a lot of insight into that, just from those talks that they gave, and I think we need to know that, because we always think there's something, real weird, but they're human beings too, and they're not happy with their role, but they have there's just no way of turning around.
Are they not happy with their role, or are they not happy with society?
Not happy with society. This one is a well-educated person. She had more education to become a pastor than just about anyone, and yet, Phyllis never left her. But she was saying that they're still working on it. Very broad-minded person, but still. Yeah. It was interesting, most interesting.
We're going to have to close because it's about 1 minute before 5, before first dinner. They rang the bell early. But thank you all very much for coming.
Thank you.